His Excellency Emmanuel Pignol, Chairperson of the Conference, to my dear friend and colleague, the Director General Graziano, my colleagues Gilbert Humbeau, David Beasley, Honourable Ministers, Ambassadors, ladies and gentlemen. It is indeed a great honour to be invited to address you this morning and to present to you the Frank McDougall Honorary Lecture. Indeed, when Graziano and Elena called me and suggested that I do this in my third week as administrator of the United Nations Development Programme, I thought that either Graziano needed some fellow Brazilian company or that they wanted to put me under due stress to see if a new administrator of the United Nations Development Programme could rise to the challenge of understanding the pathways that lie ahead for agriculture, food security, and farmers. But I think at the end of the day, the invitation also speaks to a deep commitment by the Director General and his team, by all of you who look at the future of agriculture as being inextricably linked with what your countries adopted in 2015, namely Agenda 2030. And thus, my lecture today on the agricultural economy of tomorrow and the opportunities for transforming our world, a phrase that is taken straight out of Agenda 2030, echoes to a deep conviction that my being here in my third week could not be a better signal both for the focus of the United Nations Development Programme, but also to the way that we in the United Nations system, under the leadership of the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, are called upon to rethink the way in which we support you as nations and together as a United Nations system deliver on an agenda that is indeed unprecedented, ambitious, and hopefully transformative. I also stand before you here in sharing to some extent something that Frank McDougall also had. The son of a farmer, I was born in Brazil, the son of a farmer, I chose later on in my life a different trajectory, and Frank McDougall also in his work was able to effect change in ways that perhaps he never thought possible. Indeed, when in 1943 he managed to persuade many of the leaders that brought together the conference that then led to the establishment of the Food and Agriculture Organization, I'm sure he must have had one of those moments of wondering how serendipity, wisdom, and foresight had come together. I'm truly honored to also speak in the tradition of Frank McDougall's approach to challenging and solving problems, namely bringing science and policy together and effecting through international collaboration an approach to solving problems that would certainly be more difficult and perhaps in those days not quite anticipated, but today a stark reality impossible to solve without collective action, collaboration across national boundaries. I'm also very humbled when I look at some of the speakers and lecturers who have presented in past years, amongst them two Secretary Generals, President Lula 2 years ago, Indira Gandhi, Norman Borlaug, and also a great mentor and leader in my life, Professor Amartya Sen, who you had invited to present the McDougall Lecture. I will come back to a couple of his observations later in my lecture, but let me begin by saying that in choosing the title today of the agricultural economy of tomorrow, I wanted to signal three things. One, that the focus on the farmer alone is often a misinterpretation of the freedom to choose what you do as a farmer in today's world, and never has that been more true than in the 21st century. Secondly, that the agricultural economy, as we measure it today in traditional GDP terms, would by statistical numbers actually not be a very important sector, 4% of global GDP. But as the Cardinal just presented in the message from the Holy Father, numbers, cold data, often are very misleading, because behind that 4% lie extraordinary narratives about people's livelihoods, about literally billions of people who depend on agriculture, whether daily for their food, whether for their employment, or indeed, whether also as a result of agriculture, losing certain things that we used to have in this world. So I chose the title of the agricultural economy deliberately because it is so much more than just the production of food. It is also in the spectrum of all the decisions that you take as the Food and Agriculture Organization, as ministers of agriculture in your countries, so much more than what a farmer does on his or her land. And ultimately, it also speaks to a recognition that the Agenda 2030 presented so clearly, that what happens with agriculture, as with other sectors, will determine far more and far more beyond the traditional boundaries of sectoral observations and measurements of progress, what happens to our world. The decisions of a farmer embedded in an agricultural economy, which in turn itself is embedded in national economies, in global economies, and not only economies, but social systems, ecological systems, international security systems, is inextricably linked not only to the positive aspiration of implementing Agenda 2030, achieving the Sustainable Development Goals, but indeed recognizing that agriculture and what happens in the name of agriculture touches on so much more than just the increase in food production. Let me move for a moment to the departure points that so often frame the discussion about the future of agriculture. We need more food. Yes, that is true. It's an imperative in a world with soon 10 billion people that more food is produced. But you and we all know nowadays that there are some strange and in some ways very contradictory realities in our food and agricultural economy. In a world where 800 million people, and as Graciano just pointed out, with an increasing trend, sadly again most recently, are undernourished, we also run a global agricultural economy in which more than one third of everything we produce is lost between the farmer and the consumer or just wasted. More than one third of everything that takes human labor, inputs, energy, transport, packaging, marketing, selling, never is consumed. This is not a rational global food economy or indeed a rational agricultural economy embedded in a larger consumption and production system. So the imperative of feeding more people may indeed require us to produce more food or to produce different foods or to also address an economy which somehow manages to rationalize a degree of waste which almost exceeds that of any other sector in our economy today. But the imperative of producing more food needs to be understood in a far larger and complex system. And this is what Agenda 2030, this is what member states, beginning at the Rio Plus 20 summit when heads of state requested the United Nations to come up with a new agenda for development with sustainable development goals, wanted to acknowledge that decision making in the 21st century, whether for economies as a whole, whether for a global population of 7, 8, 9 billion people, or indeed for a sector such as agriculture, would have to confront a degree of complexity and systems thinking that was not necessary in the past, or at least seemed to not be necessary in the past. When we look at agriculture today, the challenge is indeed one of addressing the future of the agricultural economy through more than just a lens of maximizing food production. And recognizing also that farmers are indeed not only producers of food. They are fathers, they are mothers, they are sons and daughters, they are custodians of their land. They pass on from one generation to the next, an asset. They are also our best hope of trying to manage the most vital resources we have on this planet, whether land or water or forests or fisheries, in a manner that will allow us to not deplete and exploit and destroy them, but indeed to maintain the ecological infrastructure, the agricultural production capacity that we will need for future generations. And yet, you all know, not least because of the extraordinary work that the Food and Agriculture Organization does with all of you, by producing every year the statistics, the vital statistics of this planet. Agriculture accounts for 70% of fresh water use. In a world where already by 2025 a third of humanity will be living under water stress conditions, it does not take much imagination that what is decided as an agricultural sector strategy on water has fundamental implications on the rest of society. I can cite many examples, but just one that has been a fascinating one to follow over 20, 30 years, the Murray-Darling Basin in Australia, where farmers, in a sense, can earn more today by selling the water that they would use to grow crops than by actually using the water to grow crops, because that water is so scarce and cities and other users need it. That is part of enlarging our appreciation of the agricultural economy of the 21st century. Yes, we have managed to do extraordinary things over the last 10,000 years when we first began with the agricultural revolutions that have come in many different phases. When we began to domesticate wild plants, began to enable sedentary agriculture to emerge. Civilizations grew around the ability to grow food, to store food, and to sustain ever larger concentrations of human beings right through the Green Revolution of the last century and into the modern 21st century, often somewhat over technology focused prospect of how to feed the world. It is an extraordinary story of human ingenuity, of a seemingly endless capacity of this planet to sustain us. But as we also know, over the last century, 3/4 of the genetic diversity in agricultural crops has now been lost. We are dependent for 90% of our caloric and protein intake on only 15 plants and 8 animal species. It's a stark contrast when you think about the extraordinary breadth and depth of scientific knowledge and inventiveness that has allowed us to come to this point, and yet in the process we have reduced the availability to us of that which this planet over millions of years has evolved and produced to a point where we are dependent on just 15 plant and 8 animal species for 90% of what we eat. That's called a high-risk strategy. And indeed, as I learned during my past year when I took on the tenure as the director of the Oxford Martin School at the University of Oxford and had the privilege of looking through the eyes of state-of-the-art research about the future of food, food systems, agriculture, how vulnerable we even are when it comes to our main food staples in terms of our capacity with the chemicals and compounds we have today to depend on just 2 or 3 to fight off some of the major blights and threats that could affect our food production. We have also already used so much land that the agricultural land in the world is highly degraded, and 1/3 of the arable land is lost either to erosion or pollution. It is a stark fact that at a moment in time when we speak about increasing agricultural production by 40, 50, 60, even 70%, we are actually already depleting the total net stock of arable land available to us in the world. So here are just 3 examples: land, water, biodiversity. The agricultural economy of the 20th century, and indeed its continued pathways that are projected for the 21st century, are, yes, producing more food, but underneath actually eroding the very capital on which we depend to produce our food. So this is a challenge that farmers alone cannot solve, and indeed farmers in today's agricultural economy, and that is perhaps one of the more tragic realities, are actually themselves trapped in the kinds of markets, pricing systems, and contradictory signals that they receive to move increasingly to becoming miners of their very own resource rather than actually sustainable managers of the foundations of an agricultural economy for the future. The pressure through global trade, liberalization, ever cheaper food, the competition, and also the distortions through subsidies or other measures that distort our ability to have a fair global marketplace in which to ensure food security, often leave farmers with very little choice. And so the future of agriculture and food production, while premised on the farmer as the agent of change and in a sense the foundation and the backbone of our food security, nationally, locally, or globally, is in fact not really capturing the reality of where decisions are made. Our agricultural economy of the 21st century takes place upstream and downstream of the farmer far more than on the morning or the beginning of a growing season when she or he has to make decisions about what to grow, what risks to take, and how to hedge against price fluctuations and many other risks that are part of daily farming. Upstream, we have a global economy today, an agricultural economy very concentrated in parts that is defined by seeds, by inputs, by technology, by fertilizers, and therefore represents already a far larger share in economic terms of what is actually the agricultural economy than the farmer who produces all that food that we normally refer to when we talk about our agricultural economy. And downstream, we have the traders, the food processors, the distribution industries, the packaging industries, all those who essentially realize the true value added once a product leaves the farm. Those are upstream and downstream the parameters that define our agricultural economy, and that you as agriculture ministers often will find yourselves also in a very strange and challenging situation. Because the mandate to influence those upstream and downstream realities are often beyond the mandates of an agriculture minister or a food and agriculture organization as well. Which points to another reason why the concept of Agenda 2030, the Sustainable Development Goals, universal for the first time in 70 years in the history of the United Nations, we actually have a development agenda that recognizes, acknowledges, and connects every country, every citizen, every production and consumption decision to a whole. And I think it was a major breakthrough in 2015 that the world was able to acknowledge that. And an integrated agenda that says you cannot solve the challenge of development through the traditional chronology of first invest, produce, then try and address your social inequalities, and finally fix your environmental outcomes that were not intended or the price of development. Climate change, with all its consequences, was perhaps the most dramatic illustration at the end of the 20th century that rather than inventing ourselves out of a dependence on our planet, it is actually the 21st century that demonstrates how dependent we are on the life support systems that make this planet work. And how with 7, 8, 9 billion people, our capacity to compromise that ability of this planet to sustain us is under threat as never before. And that therefore the modern 21st century economy, the modern 21st century farmer, or consumer, or prime minister, or agriculture minister, has to face a challenge that is truly defined by complexity and by looking at systems management as really the framework within which to work. We have found many ways to make us more independent, seemingly, of that natural platform on which we produce. But then, for example, in the United States today, 80% of antibiotics consumed are actually consumed in agriculture. We did not know that for a long time. Our dependence on ever more artificial means of controlling the risks that we associate with agriculture is simply another way of pointing out that the ability to conceive of agriculture as a system within which we are all players, often without direct influence and shaped by the decisions of others, is also something that speaks to the reality of a world that is often still very unequal in its individual national components when it comes to that global agricultural economy. So the first challenge is indeed one of understanding how sustainability in the broader sense of the word redefines the way that agriculture and that economy which drives agricultural production needs to be rethought. The second one is hunger and poverty. We are here, particularly in the United Nations and in the Food and Agriculture Organization and through Agenda 2030, which emphasizes the notion of leaving no one behind, focused on those who do not have enough food today. Yes, we are also concerned about those who consume too much food or the wrong food, and that explains that we now live in an age where both undernourishment, malnourishment, and obesity and the wrong kind of food are producing at two ends of the extreme, two phenomena that are actually threatening the health of our citizens in fundamental ways. So non-communicable diseases are another end of the spectrum of nutrition and of the kinds of diets and the calorie value that we are able to consume. But let me for a moment focus on those who may literally not survive tomorrow because they have nothing to eat. It is here that often agriculture is invoked as the critical part of ensuring that the world can be fed. And beyond the phenomenon I pointed out earlier on about food waste, let us also be clear that it is one of the ironies of our age that most of those who belong to that category of the 800 million undernourished are actually farmers. What a strange coincidence. The very people who should actually be able to feed themselves are at the front line of the greatest vulnerability and lack of resilience to shocks. Up to 80% of Africa's poor depend on agriculture, but yields are low, stagnant, and often creating a vicious cycle. Environmental shocks, civil strife, and also the prospect of an ever more systemic phenomenon of climate change or changing climates is something that is producing not only a protracted number such as 800 million undernourished, and again, I remember the cardinal's word, do not get fixated on the cold numbers. Behind every one of those 800 million people is a whole life story, a tragedy, and perhaps also a descent into a state of desperation that wasn't there before. But there is also the challenge of the acute food crisis. Right now, we are facing the unprecedented phenomenon of having to declare four concurrent droughts. At a time when we should, as a global community, be more capable, more resilient, and more effective at looking after one another in the spirit of solidarity, investing in our capacity to be more resilient and not allow a drought of 2 or 3 years to literally throw a nation into absolute desperation. At this point in time, we had in 2016 more than 100 million people globally being food insecure, 35% more than in 2015. Due to the impact of El Nino, for example, last year, but also to conflict. This is not a one-off phenomenon. They may be one-off triggers. But as a global community, in our agricultural economy, and when we invoke food security and resilience, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, we are not doing too well. In an age of unprecedented wealth, technology, markets, capacities to transport and provide food, and also in an age where our welfare systems, our risk management tools that we should deploy, should actually be able to allow farmers to survive a bad year without losing everything. And as you know, too many of you in this room right now are seeing in your countries the threats and consequences of extreme weather events such as droughts, or indeed at the other end of the extreme, floods. But let me take one more step, which takes us even further. Thinking about the future or the agricultural economy of tomorrow is actually part of transforming our world in ways that you, Graziano, already alluded to, the Prime Minister did, the Cardinal did. We are talking about a sector that actually will either allow us as societies to stay together or to fall apart. What happens in that larger agricultural economy is so fundamental in defining things that have not just to do with whether you have enough to eat in the evening, but define the livelihoods, the loss of livelihoods, the falling apart of communities under extreme stress situations, and then very often also resulting in tensions and conflicts. It does not take much imagination to see why, when there is no rainfall, pastoralists and sedentary agricultural communities are likely to be in a stronger competition. It was less obvious that this would lead to the kind of conflicts that we have now seen affect not just parts of nations, but sometimes entire nations. And perhaps even more dramatic, the prospect of some of these may in the future also result in transboundary conflict. Whether it is through the extraordinary push that drives thousands, tens of thousands, or as we heard this morning, millions of people to leave their place of abode and flee to somewhere else. Last year, we had 65 million people displaced across this planet, within countries and across national boundaries. And most of those, with all the respect for Europe's struggles to manage this, actually did not come to Europe. They went to neighboring countries. Most of the world's refugees and displaced people are harbored by those who are their neighbors, whether across boundaries or in their own countries. The stress this produces is something that we have also since learned through a great deal of empirical research can lead to pronounced insecurity. And it is quite evident that while only in 8% of the instances where drought occurred did this lead to conflict, but where we actually looked at ethnic diversity and where latent competition between ethnicities was actually prevalent or existent, an extreme weather event led to conflict in 1 out of 3 to 4 instances. And whether you take the research that is today being produced and look at the Fertile Crescent and the worst drought in record around 2008 and the factors that then triggered people to move, to dislocate, and that eventually led to a degree of instability and the outbreak of hostilities and conflict in the region, there is little doubt, first of all, that that drought was linked to climate change, and therefore understanding the implications of climate change and the additional stresses it will put on our societies, on our agricultural economy, and therefore on our capacity to handle these should never be underestimated. The IPCC to this day remains a conservative body when it comes to interpreting what is likely to happen next, and we often underestimate that. And let me just cite one example. About 8 years ago, the IPCC pegged its estimate based on all the research of expected, anticipated rise in sea levels this century between 50 to 100 centimeters, i.e. half a meter to a meter. In its latest reviews, it has had to revise this from anywhere between 1 meter to 2 meters of sea level rise by the end of this century. Ladies and gentlemen, these are dramatic changes that are not going to come at the end of the century. They are already beginning to unfold. They will become ever more serious, more dramatic, and therefore need to be brought into an understanding of the future of agriculture and our economy. So tackling hunger and poverty has as much to do with that principle of solidarity, that basic humanity that we share amongst us when one cannot survive without the other, as it has to do with cold, stark self-interest. We cannot cope with collapsing economies on the back of climate change, a depleting natural resource base, and an inability to guarantee not food in terms of a total global production figure, but food available on plates where people live on every day of the year. Let me conclude my lecture this morning by trying to point to a number of pathways in which I think we are capable of addressing this issue. And the first thing is to go back to where I began this lecture, to recognize that the solution to feeding the world cannot be reduced to or defined by the parameters of technology, which is sometimes the dream of those who are working on the cutting edge of science and in innovation. It cannot be the boundary of a farmer's field either, because that agricultural economy transcends that field and that small reality of a farmer every day 1,000 times. It must go upstream and downstream and understand the full implications of that agricultural economy. 570 million farms in the world, of which 90% are either one person or a family farm. They produce 80% of the world's food. This is the backbone of our agricultural economy of today. Yet in the way that we appreciate it, measure it, and also invest in it, really does not speak to that reality at all. 4% of GDP, by most national economists and finance ministers, not the sector that you would bet on. And here, I think, we do need to broaden the lens and begin to appreciate that in looking at the relevance and importance of farming in economic terms, but also far beyond that to our nations and our economies, we need to apply a different lens of cost and benefits. Food and maximizing food production is one, but merely one criterion. Optimizing agricultural production, the agricultural economy, may be a better way to frame, also in the context of Agenda 2030, the way we look at the future of agriculture. It is not always about producing the maximum possible that leads to sustainable food security and agricultural economies. Indeed, we also need to realize that in the way that our regulatory framework and our markets work defines whether a farmer can be more than just a person who is somewhere in the middle between an input chain and a distribution and marketing chain at the other end. When we begin to understand farming as being the backbone of our societies in providing employment, community, location, the ability of people not to have to flee the rural areas in order to feel that they have a chance to develop their either own lives or that of their families. When we recognize farmers for what they are, namely custodians of the ecological infrastructure of our nations and ultimately of this planet, that they are never paid for, and that therefore is of no economic value, and in this cutthroat competition for producing ever cheaper food, we're actually making that entire role that they play one that is economically not viable, at least in many countries in the way that we have traditionally regulated, shaped markets, and made farmers people who had no other option. And we need to understand that in looking at the future of agriculture, we should leverage the agricultural economy as the foundation upon which communities can sustain themselves. That our rural economies, and that is a theme that I know the Director General has brought to the work of the FAO since his first day of coming here, is also a way in which we can create opportunities for the 2 or 3 billion people who are joining us over the next 20 to 30 years on this planet. Not to mention all the underemployed and unemployed youth that already define so many of our nations today. Agriculture must become more than a group of people putting things in the ground, adding something else to it, harvesting it, and selling it to something else. They must be the cornerstone of a rural economy, of a village economy in the 21st century that allows through the digital economy, through the information highways, through automation, through the ability to connect educated people in villages to global marketplaces, to allow agriculture to be part of creating a different vision for how our nations develop. If the only way you can escape poverty is to move to the cities, we are condemning hundreds of millions of people to not escape poverty, but to move into areas where they will have even less and will live even more desperate lives, as we can see every day across this planet when we visit the slums of this world. But with no other option, and the sense that in that rural area nothing is likely to happen, we are abandoning almost half of humanity at the moment. And that is not only a phenomenon that we can observe in certain parts of the world, often referred to as the developing world. In the developed world, we have systematically, over the last 50 years, undermined the capacity of small and family farms to survive. My father was a farmer. I was on a farm this weekend, and I learned that basically in a country, in an economy such as Germany's, if you don't have more than 400 to 500 hectares today, you basically aren't even worth thinking about in terms of a viable farming operation. What has happened to this principle that farming is part of our community? It defines our societies. Food security is not just a matter of comparative advantage and who can produce the cheapest food where in this world. We need to appreciate that an agricultural economy is also about identity, about society, about culture, about environment, about sustainability. And that is why I thank the Director General for the invitation to address you today in memory of Frank McDougall, who saw some of those connections already, of Amartya Sen and others who have spoken here before me, and I read some of their lectures, who echo to similar themes in appealing to you as ministers of agriculture, as those who have the greatest scope for influencing the future of our agricultural economies embedded in a larger development discourse, to take more seriously the inertia that has locked us for too long in a system where farmers are less and less in control of what they can do, where our societies are facing more and more net losses of the very capital that the farming economy is using and is meant to sustain, and where if we are not careful, in the erosion of this agricultural economy lie the seeds of destruction, of conflict, and of times in which more and more people will actually not be able to stay where they have and their ancestors have stayed, sometimes for hundreds or thousands of years. That is the challenge of 21st century agricultural economies embedded in that larger notion of transforming our world. The theme of Agenda 2030, the logic, the DNA of the Sustainable Development Goals, and I believe, therefore, the challenging but ultimately enormously important and rewarding task for all of you who are looking after the future of our food security, our agriculture economies, our farmers, but ultimately also all of us who eat food every day, at least most of us, somewhere on this planet. Thank you.
Director General José Graziano da Silva, His Excellency Emmanuel F. Pignol, Secretary General Louis Gagnon, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here. Frank was not necessarily an Australian. He started in England. He came to Australia. He did a lot of work in the fruit section, and then he went to the United States and did a lot of work there. He lobbied Eleanor Roosevelt and was part of the process of trying to set up this organisation here. It was instrumental in it and did a great job. I know how these things work. I'm a politician. I'm also a farmer. My father's a farmer. I'm a farmer. In fact, if we go back to our roots in Europe, when we go to visit them, they're farmers. But I know how these conferences work. If you can remember all the speakers, you're doing exceptionally well. If you can remember what they said, you're a genius. So I'll try and keep this brief. It's really quite simple, ladies and gentlemen. We've got about, in the next 50 years, the world will have to produce as much food as it has in humanity to this point. That's our task for the next 50 years. That's pretty awesome. The result, of course, if you fail in that task, is people are going to starve to death. Now, you mightn't see them. You mightn't know them. They'll exist, though. Food is fungible like everything else. If you take something out of the stack of food in Europe, or you take something out of the stack of food in Southeast Asia, then they mightn't be in Southeast Asia or Europe where someone starves, but they might be in North Africa or another part or one of the islands. So we have to take this as an honourable and just cause. An honourable and just cause. There is nothing more honourable than feeding and clothing people. So the task you are at is an honourable task. As the Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, I had a choice of any portfolio. I choose this portfolio because it is imperative we get this calculation right. We have to realise that if there's four things I want to leave with you, I'll just try, because I know you don't remember heaps of things at these things. I'm going to give you four things. Try to remember these. The first thing you have to acknowledge is that no one's going to produce anything unless they get a fair return. Unless farmers get a fair return through the farm gate, they're not going to be motivated to grow much at all. They have to be paid a decent wage, a decent return for the endeavours that they put in. It is item number one. I said it to my department when they said, what do you got to concentrate on? I said, get a fair return back through the farm gate and other things will follow after that. So we concentrate on that. And in our nation, since we've been the government, we've increased food production by about a third across the nation, including in the irrigation areas and areas such as the Murray-Darling Basin. The second thing is trade. You've got to trade. You've got to just think of the logic of it. If Umbria just traded with Umbria, there wouldn't be much happening in Umbria. If we had just I don't know, Tennessee trading with Tennessee. There wouldn't be much happening in Tennessee. You've got to acknowledge it. You've got to trade. You've got to have the movement of product. Product's got to move. People have got to play to their strategic advantages if we're going to make this task work. And those issues are before you at the moment. You've got your free trade agreements coming up. So always push for trade. Push for trade if you want it, if you want it to prevail. If you want to prevail. Otherwise, we can go back. As I was saying in Brussels the other day, Brussels would have been supplied by people probably, you know, 150 years ago, 100 kilometres from Brussels. And not my, and it was not a great economic model. You would have had beggars on the street and people starving. Not quite the way we want to go. So let's get that trade moving as quickly as possible. The obvious one's been already mentioned by Achim, is storage. You know, we could feed about 250 million people extra a year if we got our storage right, especially into tropical areas where you get spoilage. This is something we ought to concentrate on. Our own small way, in our own nation, we've increased the tax deductibility of storage because this is absolutely important. Absolutely important. That's a low-hanging fruit, something you can do straight away. Final thing is innovation. Innovation. If we think about what Norman Borlaug did, this was instrumental. Norman Borlaug in the Green Revolution, think of the innovation he did. From about 1946 to 1963, he was instrumental in the wheat trade from Mexico increasing sixfold, because he had the capacity to see around corners and he was desirous of breaking, he was an iconoclast in some of the crazy ideas that are out there. He made sure that people looked for the next step. I'll give you one of those crazy ideas. One of the crazy ideas I had then was they believed that grain had to rest before you planted it. You know, had to have a little sleep, had a big day ahead of it. So before you planted the grain, had to give it a bit of a sleep, had to leave it in the silos. A load of rubbish. He actually fought against that in such an extent that he resigned. He said, this is crazy. We can't stick with this crazy idea. But people said, no, that's the status quo. You've got to believe in it. So he resigned, they encouraged him back in, and what an incredible endowment he was to the world. Well, we've got to try and work out how, dealing with the fact that by 2050, we're going to have 10 billion people in the world, in the next 50 years, we have to find as much food as we've produced to this point now in humanity. And we better start being prepared to be iconoclasts as well, and working out how to deal with some of these issues. Otherwise, the result of this mathematical equation is quite simple. You're all sitting there, you're sustained by protein, by carbohydrates, by fats. And if you don't have enough, if the equation's wrong, you die. Very simple equation. So if we're going to try and make this work, we're going to have to be iconoclasts as well. And we can't just sit in some sort of religious vessel thinking that we can somehow make this all work without actually looking around corners. We're going to have to look at genetic modification. I get very frustrated when people say you shouldn't. Wheat itself, a hexaploid gene, they were talking about before, it's a hexaploid gene. We've been mucking about with wheat for about 10,000 years. 10,000 years. In fact, the genome is so complex, it's more complex than the human genome. Harder to map than the human genome. And we don't have another 10,000 years to get to 2050. We don't have even another 10 years that Norman Borlaug had in trying to get that increase in wheat for Mexico, which then he took into Pakistan and around the world. We don't have that time. We've got to move now. We've got to move right now. And we've got to use the instruments that we have at our disposal, that intellect that resides there at the moment. We have to make a stand. If you want to be on the side of the person, as happened in Australia, who goes out and whippersnips the genetic modified wheat crop because they think that is a form of protest, no, that's just another mechanism that's going to make this equation so much more difficult. We've got to be smart enough to deal with these issues. You've got to remember, even with what we do at the moment, we're trying to get new yields. All we're doing is bombarding it with radiation, bombarding it with chemicals, trying to create mutations, and then picking the better mutations to use ourselves. That's basically what you do with genetic modification as well. So we've got to be brave enough and be the iconoclast. And when these movements come against us and say, oh, you can't use that, well, then you've got to be aware that we're not going to make this equation work. So what are the two big ones there I see? Well, part of it relates back to Norman. We're going to have to look at this photo. He was looking at photoperiodism. the capacity of the use of light and through the process of plant and photosynthesis. We should be looking at that again as well. How we get a more efficient use of the genome for photosynthesis, because that will give us an exponential jump in growth. And they're doing that work at the moment. That work is happening at the moment. If you can get the C4 gene and you can splice it into the C3 gene, so you get the gene out of sorghum or sugarcane, you can manage to splice it into things such as wheat, you're going to have that exponential growth. If you can also have that plant as being nitrogen fixating, that's also going to help you as well. If a conference such as this wants to concentrate on things such as that, if it wants to actually focus on the reality of how you create more food, then you are doing a worthwhile job. You've got to remember, global warming, whether we can fix it or not, it's going to be there. It's something you're going to have to deal with. I don't know how you deal with it, but we've got to try and manage it. You've got to deal with it. But don't think that if you just concentrate on that, that you can put aside the issue of how you actually feed people. That is going to be your task. That is what you in this room, you're going to be judged by. You're going to be judged by what movements and what actions you took today to try and make sure that by 2050, that people weren't starving. If you do that, then you're part of that noble and just occupation, that noble cause of farming, farmers who feed and clothe people. That is your part of this process. And I'll tell you, and I'll close with this. One thing you all have in common is you're involved in government, in some way, shape or form. You're involved with government. You'd ask yourself, where's agriculture in your cabinet? Where is it? Is it there? How much of a say does it have? How much resources does it have? What sort of resources are you putting towards it? How seriously do you take it? That's the question you take back to your own countries as to what you are doing. Anyway, I wish you all the best in your deliberations. It's great to be here. And now I've got to go back to Australia. So all the best and God bless.
Mr. Chairperson, Excellencies, Director General, ladies and gentlemen, I should like to begin by offering my congratulations to the Honorable Emmanuel Pino, Secretary for Agriculture of the Philippines, on his election as chairperson of this 40th session of the FAO Conference. I wish Mr. Pino well as he guides us through this intense week of deliberations. And I would like to thank Mr. Kim Steiner, Administrator of the United Nations Development Program, for delivering a perceptive and stimulating McDougall lecture, the keynote speech that sets the tone for the conference. I also wish to acknowledge the statement made by the Director General, which delegates will bear in mind during the deliberations that will take place in this plenary hall and in the commissions throughout this week. I am sure we all appreciated the forward-looking and constructive approach which characterizes not only Mr. Graziano's address to the conference, but also his leadership of this organization. As many of you will know, this is the second time that I have the honor to address the conference in my role as independent chairperson of the FAO Council. And now that I have reached the end of my second term of office, I should like to share some reflections on the past 4 years. But before I start highlighting Council's recent past, please allow me to reflect briefly on the state of food and agriculture across the globe. We have already heard from the previous speakers about the challenges impacting on food security and nutrition. Clearly, the world has witnessed significant leaps in technology and innovation that have provided incomparable opportunities for increased agricultural production. These positive trends should not, however, detract our attention from the continuing threats posed by climate change, to which agriculture not only has to adapt, but also as an important mitigation role. Unsustainable production practices, inequalities in income, displacement, and migration. All these factors and many more which jointly hinder our efforts to fight hunger and malnutrition. FAO is in the middle of this complex situation. Ladies and gentlemen, since 2012, FAO and its members have embarked on a joint exercise to decide how the organization should be positioned to ensure its efficiency and effectiveness in a world struggling with complex and protracted crisis. Furthermore, as we all are aware from our experience at national level, resources for development are ever more scarce, and this calls for prioritization of FAO activities and programs. Under the leadership of the Director General, and within the constraints of available resources, FAO management and members, in line with the Director General's strategic thinking process, refocused the strategic direction of the organization. The outcome of this process was the setting out of 5 comprehensive strategic objectives upon which the work of the organization was aligned. The structural reform of the organization has led to a streamlined and effective headquarters and a further consolidation of the decentralized offices. The structural reform of the organization was complemented by the reform of its governance structure. And in this regard, I believe it is particularly significant that consensus on the budget level for 2018-2019 was found upstream of this session, when in May 2017, the Council agreed to forward a draft resolution on budgetary appropriation to this session of conference for approval. This was also the case in March 2015, and it was referred to as an historic consensus at that time. Ladies and gentlemen, this constructive outcome is due in large measure to willingness of members to work productively with each other and also with management within the context of the strategic framework in order to reach consensus. I am therefore grateful to members and management alike for your readiness to engage with complex and sometimes divisive issues in a frank and respectful manner. Ladies and gentlemen, I should like to briefly run through some key issues discussed by the Council over the past 4 years. My intention is to give you just a sense of my perception, also the range and scope of the work covered during the 10 sessions I chaired. Some of these issues became recurring themes over the period, and some were also discussed in informal intersessional consultations, often mandated by Council itself. I know some members will recall that it took a decade-long reform process and many sessions of Council and working groups to develop the Council's present business-like and transparent decision-making processes. Indeed, I am in a privileged position of having seen governance reforms coming to fruition over the past decades, as I was the vice chairperson of the process. Looking back over the past 4 years, I can confirm that positive changes did occur, and that the way Council works today is undoubtedly more focused and more efficient. For example, Council's constructive approach was very evident during my first mandate, when we built upon a good team dynamic in FAO-WHO joint working group that negotiated the 2 outcome documents of the International Conference on Nutrition. This led to a successful ICN2 in November 2014. Later in December 2014, the Council tasked me with leading an open-ended working group on FAO's work on antimicrobial resistance. The outcome of these informal meetings was a conference resolution adopted unanimously by conference at its last session in June 2015. Subsequently, I was mandated by the Council to hold consultations with the regional groups and open to all members with a view to reaching agreement on the proposed rules for participation of civil society organizations and private sector representatives in the FAO meetings. Again, informal intersessional consultations were the basis of the decision by Council to maintain a status quo in this key aspect of FAO activities. Likewise, the outcome of the important review of decentralized offices was discussed constructively and negotiated through informal meetings and led to a clear decision by Council and the Conference. All of these decision-making processes combined informal negotiation among members with high-value input by management in an informal setting before governing bodies endorsed our decisions formally. Chairperson, before concluding these brief remarks, I would like to express my gratitude to the chairperson of the Program Committee, Finance Committee, and Committee on Constitution and Legal Matters. I am grateful to them for their unfailing support throughout their term of office. I am also very grateful to the chairpersons of the technical committees and the regional conferences. Ladies and gentlemen, as well as reaching the end of my 4 years as independent chairperson of the FAO Council, I am also completing a 13-year period in Rome. Before becoming independent chairperson of the Council, I served as a permanent representative of the United Republic of Tanzania to the Rome UN-based agencies, that is FAO, IFAD, and WFP. I am happy that the collaboration of the three Rome-based UN agencies is enhanced for effectiveness and efficiency. Mr. Chairperson, I am grateful to the government of Tanzania for having assigned me with this important role and subsequently for having nominated me for the office of an independent chairperson. I am also grateful to all members for having made my task much easier by coming to talk to me informally about emerging issues. I'd also like to thank our host country, the Republic of Italy, for its constant and generous support for FAO. Likewise, I have also had many opportunities, whether as permanent representative of my country or as independent chairperson of Council, to appreciate how the FAO Secretariat provides highly professional and reliable assistance both during and between sessions of Council and the other governing bodies. Before concluding, let me remark on the ability of the multilateral organizations like FAO to work with members to find solutions to intricate global issues and the crises that afflict the contemporary world in the field of food and agriculture. The complexity of the challenges we face requires, more often than not, a degree of compromise by all parties. And compromise is, of course, easier to achieve in a forum such as the Council, where respect for diversity of opinion is a guiding principle. Mr. Chairperson, please now allow me to conclude by saying how much I am indebted to my loving wife and family for having constantly supported me here in Rome and at a distance. I would never have been able to carry out my functions as ambassador and then as independent chairperson without their patience, understanding, and encouragement. I am grateful to them for that, as I am grateful to Almighty God for having granted me sufficient good health to face what have been both rewarding and challenging years. Mr. Chairperson, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for your kind attention.